no state is doing the best job. Everybody could do better. We have to do better in order to put this pandemic behind us.
COVID-19 vaccine distribution has been not so good. One reason?
The government really has failed because there was not much planning done for that last mile of vaccination.
I'm Cindy Rodriguez in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, January 6th, how the U.S. can get on track. Plus, we'll talk to the mayor of Plano, Texas, about his city's vaccination plan.
In times of crisis, you have to take action and take things into your own hands. And so we're figuring out how we might be able to centralize the process a bit more locally so that we can do the best job for our citizens.
And we're checking in on Kenosha, Wisconsin, where the DA has decided not to press charges against the police officer who shot Jacob Blake in the back 7 times. The big question facing Americans right now, how can we get COVID-19 vaccines to more people faster? While we know the development of effective COVID-19 vaccines happened faster than even many experts predicted, now that these vaccines are ready for distribution, the rollout has been bumpy, to say the least. According to the CDC, more than 17 million vaccines have been distributed across the United States as of Tuesday morning. But less than 5 million of those vaccines have actually been administered. And from state to state, distribution has varied widely. Only a handful of states have administered more than half of the vaccines they've received, while more than a dozen have given out less than 25%. U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Jerome Adams spoke yesterday about the vaccine rollout on the Today Show.
I really want to tell people that three things we're doing. Number one, we're going to increase funding, more funding. We're going to make sure that congressional funding that was appropriated gets to the states. More locations. We went from 1,000 locations the first week to 12,000 locations now. And more priority groups. So your headline today really should be Surgeon General tells states and governors to move quickly to other priority groups. If the demand isn't there in 1A, go to 1B and continue on down. And if the demand isn't there in one location, move those vaccines to another location.
The question for today, how can the U.S. turn things around and quickly get vaccine distribution on track? Here with me is Dr. Amish Adalja, an infectious disease physician and a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Thanks for coming on The Takeaway, Doctor.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
So, Doctor, let's start with hospitals. They were rightly given priority for the vaccine, but now they're getting blamed for the slow rollout and for not vaccinating workers fast enough. So you work at several hospitals. Can you give us a look into what's happening there?
You have to remember that there's no such thing as a hospital worker whose only job is to vaccinate people. So what hospitals are doing are pulling people with other jobs to run a COVID vaccination clinic. And these COVID vaccines are not the same thing as giving employees tetanus shots or hepatitis B shots or influenza shots. There's a lot involved. And the same hospitals that are tasked with responding to an inordinate number of patients are being asked to vaccinate. So there's a lot of precautions that they have to put in place. They've got to set up timings for people to be vaccinated. They've got to find a place to vaccinate people and a place where people can stay 15 minutes after their shot in case they have an allergic reaction. They have to be in close proximity to an emergency department in case a severe allergic reaction happens. And it just takes some time to scale this up. So hospitals don't have the resources to do this in a rapid fire manner. And I think they shouldn't be blamed for this. They're being actually tasked to do something where the government really has failed because there was not much planning done for that last mile of vaccination. And it fell to hospitals to set up their own programs and their own prioritization and all of that. And it's not surprising to me that there's been lags and delays, but it is speeding up. And I do think that the answer here is more resources.
What could hospitals do with those more resources?
If hospitals had more resources, they could have vaccination basically happening 24/7 instead of at specific times. They could vaccinate more people at a given time instead of having certain slots for people to come to be vaccinated. They would have other people to be able to monitor people after their vaccination. So if there is an allergic reaction, it's not the same people that are giving the vaccine that have to kind of keep their eye on who's around in the room that might be having an allergic reaction. all of that would make vaccination more seamless and faster. But some of the slowness is because this vaccine is available on an emergency use authorization, and that requires forms and consent and checking that consent to make sure it's all accurate. All of that does take time, which is very different than when you go to get a flu shot at employee health at a hospital. They basically just jab you as soon as you walk in the door.
You yourself have had your first dose, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Have you witnessed any reluctance or skepticism?
In one of the hospitals I'm on staff at, there's a lot of misinformation being spread amongst certain members of the healthcare staff, including nurses and doctors, where basically every conspiracy theory that you've maybe seen on social media is getting repeated in a hospital hallway. So yes, that does happen. In my experience, it's been a really minimum of people and not something that's generally reflective of what healthcare workers think of this vaccine. But clearly, the anti-vaccine movement and all of those conspiracy theories, healthcare workers are not, unfortunately, immune from it. And that has played a role trying to combat that misinformation with facts.
And so, Doctor, how do you balance the need to prioritize healthcare workers and the elderly with also just getting as many people vaccinated as possible who want the vaccine?
You have to remember that the overall goal is to get all the eligible populations vaccinated so that this public health emergency is behind us and we cross the herd immunity threshold and hospitals are not inundated. There is a reason for the priority scheme, though, in order to get the vaccine into people where it will have the biggest impact fast, and that's healthcare workers, nursing home residents, and then kind of moving through other priority groups. But you have to remember that we can't be dogmatically wed to that. And if that schedule is an obstacle to people getting vaccinated, if it's causing hospitals consternation on how they're going to vaccinate and how they're going to deal with excess doses, maybe they've unfrozen a lot more doses than they needed that day and they've got some that they're going to either throw out or give to somebody that's not priority group 1A, the answer there is to give it to somebody who's in another priority group, because you have to remember the overarching goal is to get people vaccinated, and we can't let an overly bureaucratic process stymie that goal. And it's not right for governors and other politicians to try and penalize hospitals for doing the best they can. And I think that's the most counterproductive thing I've heard of, is fining hospitals or decreasing their allocation if they're going outside of the priority group, because the goal is always going to be to get the shot into people's arms.
And who would be the next priority group? Would it be people with pre-existing conditions, for instance?
So overall, the CDC says priority group 1B would be people that are above the age of 75 years of age, as well as front-facing workers, so meatpacking plants or in grocery stores or transportation workers. That's the overall phase 1B. But some states are saying we're going to go to maybe above age 65. So there is some variation from state to state, but it's generally people that are going to be dealing with the general public, but they're not healthcare workers, as well as people of advanced age, because we know they have a high risk for severe complications.
Are there states that have done a particularly good job so far?
Well, if you look at states and the number of doses that they've allocated, North Dakota, South Dakota stand out. They were places that got hit very hard most recently, and they seem to be rolling out their vaccine at a faster pace than many other states. Some states only maybe 15% of their doses have been allocated. But again, that may be a lot of the idiosyncrasies of each state, and you likely will see things homogenize soon as states start ramping up and getting things in order. But I would say in general, no state is doing the best job. Everybody could do better, and we have to do better in order to put this epidemic pandemic behind us.
So what are you looking for the Biden administration to do? What can be done to speed things up?
The Biden administration can ensure that states have the funding, and there was a funding bill passed on Christmas Eve, but it's also just trying to understand what's going on in each state and meeting states where they are. Some states may need different types of help, and I think that's going to be important, is having the CDC step into its role of being this coordinating body for the states and allowing the public health response to really be fine-tuned by the CDC adding its expertise to what's going on in each state. I think it's also the case that we need more guidance on what to do when you have leftover doses and nobody left in the priority group. And yesterday, the CDC did have a press conference or a meeting where they did talk about the fact that the goal is not to have vaccine in the fridge, but into people's arms, and we shouldn't be wasting doses or doing anything like that. So that type of work, that kind of leadership of how this vaccination program should go would be very useful. I also think the federal government should think about trying to help coordinate mass vaccination sites, especially as we get into the community dwelling people who aren't in hospitals or nursing homes, who are relatively easy to vaccinate, but people who live at home. Can they be done at stadiums? Can they be done at convention centers? Can we use old school gymnasiums? During H1N1, I got vaccinated at an old school gym. can we start doing that to make things move much more seamlessly and faster, sort of borrowing from what Israel is doing, which is the country that's leading the world in vaccinations?
You mentioned H1N1. I'm wondering if there's lessons from past vaccine rollouts that we could be using right now.
We did learn from the 2009 H1N1 pandemic, but I think we're still making some of those same mistakes. You know, in the past, there's these, you know, these really legendary stories of vaccinating the entire population of New York City with a smallpox case. And I think that's kind of from a bygone era where people were able to do things in a much more orderly fashion than we can do today.
And back then, was there much less skepticism? I mean, the vaccine has been so politicized at this point.
The vaccine hesitancy and anti-vaccine movement has been around since the late 1700s. With the first vaccine, the vaccine against smallpox that Edward Jenner created, that also created the anti-vaccine movement. So they've always been around. But I think in the 1940s, in the 1950s, you have a different era where science was respected, where people hailed Jonas Salk as a hero and had ticker tape parades for him when the polio vaccine was announced. Today, when a new vaccine is announced, the first thing you find are conspiracy theories, and people don't run and embrace vaccines the way they did in earlier eras. I think we should embrace vaccines the way we embrace a new iPhone release, that everybody's excited, everybody's lining up, everybody wants to have this great piece of technology. But I think we're far from that era, and I think that's also part of it, that we know that not everybody's going to take this vaccine because of so much misinformation out there, and it is hard to be able to combat it all, especially because the anti-vaccine movement is so organized and they are so proactive, and we in the medical community tend to be very reactive and keep shooting down arbitrary assertions from the anti-vaccine movement rather than actually presenting the positive case for the vaccine.
For those of us who do want the vaccine, when can we expect it for the general public?
The general public, I suspect, likely have access to the vaccine in the summer is when if you have no risk factors, if you're an average risk person, that you'll have access to it. You may see some of that coming out earlier in different states, depending on how the priority groups are. Remember, states are allocated based on their adult population, so some states have more or less of the other priority groups, so you may get it earlier. And I am hearing about people getting it early because they're hanging around hospitals where hospitals have extra doses and they're giving them. But I think for the most people to get it, it's going to be the summer.
Dr. Amish Adalja is an infectious disease physician and a senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Thank you so much, Doctor.
Thank you for having me.
As we've just heard, the rollout of the coronavirus vaccine has been complicated and fraught with logistical nightmares. Texas is just one of the many states currently dealing with these rollout issues. The state will have received 1.5 million doses by the end of the week, and as of Tuesday, only 33% of those doses have actually been administered, according to the CDC. Back in June, The Takeaway spoke with the mayor of Plano, Texas, Harry LaRosselier, about the steps the city was taking to control the spread of COVID-19 and the lack of support he and some of his fellow Texas mayors felt they were getting from Texas Governor Greg Abbott. Mayor LaRosselier joins us again now to talk about how the vaccine rollout has been for Plano. Mayor, thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Cindy. Thank you for having me on.
So tell us, how many vaccines did your city receive and how many have been administered so far?
So it's really a interesting and moving target. The state has given the city of Plano 500 doses so far for our 1A recipients. And that's essentially our frontline workers, or EMS, and first responders. And that's been used already. They are also sending to pharmacies and hospitals and physicians, but it is happening in a very haphazard and unsystematic way. So it is putting some challenges on us in terms of the expectation of when and how this will continue to proceed.
Okay, and so just to give people context, what's the population of Plano?
So we're a population of 300,000. We're the largest city in Collin County, which is about a million people in our county. So we're just north of Dallas County, and it's really difficult because what we're finding is that certain areas in Texas are getting more than they need. Some areas are getting less than they need, and there's a discrepancy where you might have a smaller city receive a larger dosage than they actually can administer, and they're starting to go to, they're holding on to the vaccine, where cities like Plano, we desperately need more, for even just to get to our first responders and our essential workers.
500 seems like a very small number to have received. Is that what you were expecting, or were you expecting much more?
So that's a loaded question, Sydney, when you think about it, because the lack of information or communication has been a difficult process to work through. We don't know what our dosage will be until 24 hours before we get it. And so that means we'll know a day before we're going to get X amount, and then we have to be fully prepared to distribute and administer it. And so 500 is not enough, and we anticipate more, but I just don't think there's been enough coordination among our cities. And so we're working on doing that locally here with our county and our other cities. In times of crisis, you have to take action and take things into your own hands. And so we're figuring out how we might be able to centralize the process a bit more locally so that we can do the best job for our citizens throughout the region.
Does that mean you could go to some of these other places who have potentially more vaccine than they need?
Yeah, so the plan, very loosely, we're in discussions with the other major cities in Collin County, so that and the county itself, where hopefully there'll be a, you know, we work on getting a database, and whoever has the vaccines, whether it be Plano or somewhere else, we go off that list, and it'll be a question of which city, local city, you'll go to rather than your own city. We've also made it clear to the state that we are willing to be a facility to administer the vaccines to the general public. Right now, the vaccines we're getting is for city staff, but we've kind of raised our hand and said we're willing to do our part to administer the vaccine to anybody. And so our goal will be to set up sites within the city, you know, city facilities, where we can set up a safe environment to allow those vaccines to occur. And once we get them, we will get them into the people's arms. It's just a question of us getting it to us first.
So what does COVID look like right now in Plano? What's the rate of infection?
So rate of infection is right around 15%. And so as a result, we've had to scale back. Texas, more so than many other places, I think, a bit more liberal in terms of their allowance to conduct business. So, you know, I'm from New York, and I had visited my mother, who still lives in New York. And it's a completely different environment, because you can go to a Plano or a Texas restaurant, and it's at 50%, and it was at 75% capacity. And because of the infection rate increasing to over 15% statewide, that got scaled back to 50%. But that's still more than a lot of other places that don't allow indoor dining at all.
Right. And are you able to scale it back even more?
Yeah. So Governor Abbott has provided a framework that if there's a certain level that achieved, again, in terms of the positivity rate, infection rate, that it can get scaled back. But so far, I believe we're holding steady here at that 50% level. Locally, we cannot pass an ordinance to supersede the governor's orders, and so emergency orders. And so that was something that happened over the past few months during the shutdown and the mask and all that. There was some local cities that were looking to be a bit more proactive, and that was taken away from us. That local authority was taken away from us.
So what about the people of Plano? Are they ready? Are you seeing any skepticism, or do you think that once you have the vaccine, it will be easily distributed?
Yeah, so that's the encouraging part, is that we're sensing there's a high desire for people to want to get vaccinated. And so I guess if you're looking for a silver lining, there's enough people that are in line raising their hands that want the vaccine. It's on our part, and I say our collectively from a government part, to make it available, because there's people who want it. And we want as many people to get it, and we want to achieve herd immunity. And so we're encouraged by that. But, you know, you mentioned skepticism. I think that's part of American mindset now. And, you know, we're getting I'm getting the emails and calls that, am I hoarding the vaccine and why haven't I given it out? And the answer simply is we don't have it. And if once we have it, it doesn't do us any good to keep it. It's better in someone's arm than in a refrigerator. And so the frustration is being demonstrated that way when people kind of say those type of things.
And Mayor, were there parts of Plano that were hardest hit, and are you prioritizing those communities?
Yeah, so we're fortunate in the sense that we're a fairly healthy community. And so during the surge, it was tough because our neighboring city, for example, Dallas, our biggest major city just south of us, was going through a lot of hardship, and that did come into Plano quite a bit. We're really fortunate in that sense that we have a fairly healthy community. But you know what? One death is too much. And if we can protect ourselves, then we can protect the cities around us. And so it's important that we just move forward in that positive way.
Mayor, we're going to have to leave it there. Mayor Harry LaRossiliere is the mayor of Plano, Texas. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Cindy. And I look forward to 2021 being a better and healthier year for all of us involved. Thank you for having me.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with psychologist Jonathan Haidt about his book, The Anxious Generation.
We're overprotecting in one place, and I'm saying, lighten up, let your kids out. And we're underprotecting in another, and I'm saying, don't let your kids spend 9 hours a day on the internet talking with strange men. It's just not a good idea.
Jonathan Haidt on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
In August, a white police officer in Kenosha, Wisconsin, shot a black man, Jacob Blake, 7 times while responding to a domestic violence call. Blake was paralyzed. Yesterday, a big announcement from the Kenosha County District Attorney.
No Kenosha law enforcement officer in this case will be charged with any criminal offense.
The shooting brought people into the streets in civil unrest in the days and weeks that followed. During the protests, Illinois teenager Kyle Rittenhouse killed 2 people and injured a third. Also coming yesterday in Kenosha was his not guilty plea. There's a lot to get to, and we've got Gina Barton to help us understand it all. She's an investigative reporter covering criminal justice issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, thank you so much for being here.
Glad to be here.
So there's a lot to discuss here. So let's start with yesterday's announcement from the Kenosha County District Attorney. Why aren't local prosecutors seeking charges?
The prosecutor explained his reasoning in that if he were to take a case against one of the police officers to trial, there would be a very effective self-defense plea available. And that's because Jacob Blake did have a knife at the time he was shot. There's some dispute about what he was doing with that knife, whether he had threatened officers with it. The police say he did. He says he didn't. But in any case, the prosecutor seems to think a defense attorney could convince a jury that the officer acted in self-defense.
Okay. And so does this decision apply to all the officers involved?
The prosecutor spent about 2 hours explaining his decision not to charge Rustin Chesky, who actually fired the 7 shots that hit Jacob Blake. But he did add that he was also not going to charge the other 2 officers who were on the scene who did not fire. And he also was not going to charge Mr. Blake with anything related to that day.
Okay. And where is Rustin Chesky today? Has he been fired?
No, all 3 of the officers who were on the scene that day are still with the Kenosha Police Department, but they are on administrative leave. I believe the next step will be for the police department to do an internal investigation about whether the officers violated any department rules. The only thing that theoretically could happen is if the U.S. attorney decides to look into the case, there's still the possibility of civil rights charges being filed at the federal level. I don't think that's likely, but it could still happen.
Okay. Now, the city and state took steps to prepare for any potential unrest stemming from this decision. So what did they decide to do, and was it necessary?
The city and criminal justice officials, law enforcement in Kenosha on Monday started taking steps to prevent any sort of rioting, looting, arson, property damage. They put fences and concrete barriers around the courthouse and the jail. It turned out not to be necessary. There was a vigil and a rather small march, but nothing got out of hand last night. I think that might be because of the weather. When this initially happened in August, it was 87 degrees the night Jacob Blake was shot. And now, of course, there's half a foot of snow on the ground and it's cold out.
Have you heard from Jacob Blake's family yet?
Jacob Blake's family did have a gathering yesterday afternoon as the decision was being handed down. And understandably, they're disappointed. His uncle said they were given rocks and glass. And they all feel that Jacob still needs justice and that there was not justification for him to be shot 7 times.
So, Gina, there's another development out of Kenosha, and that's that Kyle Rittenhouse has pleaded not guilty to all the charges against him. What is he claiming?
Kyle Rittenhouse is claiming self-defense. There was a gunshot that went off before Rittenhouse started shooting. It turned out not to be any of the people he ended up firing at who had fired that gun as a warning shot. But he said he clearly acted in self-defense and has pleaded not guilty.
Okay, and just remind us what he's being charged with.
Kyle Rittenhouse is being charged now with several different crimes, including 2 counts of homicide and 1 of attempted homicide for the man that he seriously wounded. Also, he was 17 at the time, so he was too young to carry a gun, so he was charged with that. Also, curfew violation.
Okay, and he's out on bail, correct?
Right. Kyle Rittenhouse's bail was set at $2 million, and there was a big fundraising campaign among right-wing groups and celebrities and people in favor of gun rights, so he was able to post that, and he's free now.
Okay, and do you know who his defense team is?
Kyle Rittenhouse's defense team has changed several times, but he's been represented by some famous national names as well as local attorneys here in Wisconsin.
What's been the response to yesterday's news from the families of those Rittenhouse killed?
I spoke with the attorney for the man who was seriously wounded by Rittenhouse, and she said the victims of Rittenhouse feel similarly to the family members of Jacob Blake. The shooting of Jacob Blake was the thing that set off all of the violence that resulted in Rittenhouse shooting these 3 men, and they feel that the officers need to be held accountable.
I'm also wondering if there's been any meaningful reform in Kenosha since Blake's shooting and the subsequent protests.
The authorities in Kenosha have talked a lot about wanting to use the shooting of Jacob Blake as an opportunity to try and bring community members together. They've had several listening sessions where people have come together and talked about some of the race and racism problems in Kenosha. They're hopeful that after this process, they will be able to implement some meaningful reforms and also make the community a better place to live.
Has there been any changes in the police department that bring more accountability to the police department?
One of the issues with Kenosha is that their police officers do not wear body cameras. And between the time Jacob Blake was shot in August and now, the police there still don't wear body cameras. They don't have body cameras. So the biggest push that's been happening is to get all of the officers there equipped with those devices. The district attorney has said he's in favor of that, but so far it hasn't happened.
That is Gina Barton. She's an investigative reporter covering criminal justice issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, we hope to check back with you as this case continues on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We turn now to another police shooting and its aftermath. On December 22nd of 2020, Andre Hill was shot and killed by police in Columbus, Ohio, after a non-emergency call reported someone was turning a car on and off. When police arrived, body camera footage showed Andre walking out of a garage with his cell phone in hand. And in a brief instant, police fatally shot him. Police handcuffed Andre and neglected to give him any first aid as he lay dying on the ground. Yesterday, community members gathered for Andre's public memorial service. Here's Reverend Al Sharpton.
Anybody that stood there with their body cam off and then began conjuring up an alibi and then let him lay there struggling and then look at a man that on his way to the other side and say he's still breathing, handcuff him. All of you need to face the bar of justice.
I'm joined now by Farnoosh Amiri, a reporter with the Report for America Associated Press State House Initiative in Ohio. Farnoosh, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, Farnoosh, you've been speaking with community members and people who knew Andre Hill. So tell us what they've been saying about him.
Yeah, so we've spoken to a number of Hill's friends and family members, and they kind of all describe him in the same way. He was a hardworking, generous, and strategic guy who tended to bring people together in his life.
So walk us through the shooting. You know, the body camera footage shows police walking up to someone's garage. Tell us, why were they there in the first place?
Yeah, so Andre was visiting a friend in a Columbus neighborhood nearby, and a neighbor made a non-emergency call, a 311 call, about a car in the driveway that was turning on and off, seeming to not be able to work the car. So Officer Adam Coy with the Columbus Division of Police responded to the call around close to after 1 a.m., and a 60-second body cam footage shows Hill coming out from the garage, holding a cell phone in his left hand, and his right hand appears obscured in the video. Within seconds, Coy shoots Hill multiple times, and police ended up finding no gun at the scene. What's interesting about the body cam footage is that there's no audio of it because he did not turn his body camera on until after the shooting. But there's a playback feature that shows you 60 seconds before that. So that is the only reason we have any footage of the incident.
I see. Interesting. And just again, to clarify, this was a 311 call, not a 911 call.
Yes, a non-emergency call.
And so tell us about Adam Coy. What's his history as a police officer?
Yeah, so he is a 19-year veteran of the Columbus Division of Police. He actually, going through his personnel file, we found a number of complaints against him, one of them including a routine traffic stop where he bashed the head of the person in the traffic stop against his hood of his car. So there was a number of complaints against him. And Reverend Al Sharpton and a number of his family members questioned yesterday why he was even on the force, let alone allowed to respond to a 311 call like that.
And so he's been fired. Tell us on what grounds, but also tell us, are prosecutors investigating the shooting too, and which ones?
Yeah, he was fired from the Columbus Division of Police on December 28th. It was actually quite a quick turnaround as a number of cases. I mean, the one that you were just speaking about in Kenosha, rarely do these cases end up in firings, but this one, less than a week later, the Columbus Chief of Police and the Public Security Safety Director ordered his firing, saying there's no way they could defend it. There's also an internal police investigation into the other two officers who were there to determine if they violated police protocol by not providing aid in an adequate amount of time. Separately from the police investigation, there is a criminal investigation ongoing. The Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost has been named special prosecutor in that case. The U.S. Attorney's Office of Central Ohio is involved, and they've also asked for the help of the FBI's Civil Rights Division to see if there were any civil rights violations.
Okay, so there's a lot more to learn about this shooting. What's been the response from the community so far, and what are they demanding from local law enforcement and from the city of Columbus?
Hill was killed 3 days before Christmas, but that did not stop demonstrators and protesters in Columbus from hitting the streets. Even when it was snowing or Christmas Eve, the activist groups had just organized a number of protests for Casey Goodson Jr., a 23-year-old Black man who was killed by a sheriff's deputy in Columbus 3 weeks prior. So this is pretty for them. They tell me that they're used to pivoting, as there have been a number of high profile police shootings of Black men in Columbus in recent years. But it seems like many of them, I mean, they're reaching a boiling point of when do things change. And it seems like even the Columbus mayor, Andrew Ginther, has been really vocal about this and really kind of putting himself on the line to say, like, I do not, this does not represent Columbus. This does not represent the police officers in this city.
So this frustration has a history. Can you tell us a little bit about the police department in Columbus, Ohio, over the years and decades?
Yeah, so there have been a number of cases. None of them have made kind of the national news that Andre Hill's case made, or even Casey Goodson Jr.'s case made. A lot of those times, there was no body camera footage available. There was kind of a he said, she said situation between the family and the police. So there was actually a unit created to investigate these types of police-involved shootings. And there's been a lot of criticism of that unit because community members and family members think that it's the police investigating themselves. After the protest in June for George Floyd's death in Columbus, they got really intense here in Columbus, Ohio. And the mayor of Columbus actually asked the attorney general's office if any sort of case between a police shooting anyone would go straight to them, so it would not be under the Columbus police investigation.
Farnoosh, thank you so much for covering this issue.
Thank you guys for having me.
Farnoosh Amiri is a reporter with the Report for America Associated Press Statehouse Initiative in Ohio. We're going to end today's show talking about the Electoral College count happening in Congress today. It's the final step in certifying Joe Biden as our nation's next president. And historically, the vote count is a largely ceremonial process. But like everything else this election cycle, the proceedings are expected to be more contentious than usual. A number of Republicans in both the House and Senate have said they would challenge the results in today's joint session. Here to discuss all this and more is Sarah Binder, a professor of political science at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So let's just start with some basics. What is the point of today's proceeding and why do we have this count?
Well, the point here is to count up all of the Electoral College votes which were cast in the states as we follow the Constitution. So the Constitution said it's not enough just to have the states' Electoral College meet. We're going to count them all up, one final count, and it's going to be done by the Congress sitting together with the Vice President presiding because he's the President of the Senate. So the point here is to make sure and to review essentially all these certificates, but really it's a counting exercise, following the Constitution and the laws that have elaborated the details for the day.
Okay, so then to clarify, they're not certifying, they're just counting?
They're really not certifying. And they're in the wake of a very contested election in the late 19th century, the Congress and the President signed into law a very strict set of procedures. And those procedures, the Electoral Count Act, that does the hard work of the certification. What's really happening here is these certificates are sent to Washington, to the Vice President, to the National Archives. The Vice President is told in the Constitution essentially to open up the envelopes and hand them to tellers who will count them. It really is a counting exercise, which, as we'll see, right, is why it's given a lot of eye rolling and a lot of concern about the fact that there's going to be challenges potentially on the floor during today's counting of the electoral votes.
Right. So talk about that a little bit. How have the president's ongoing claims about voter fraud affected the process or the perception of it? And is it fair to say that this year's count is like no other in history?
Security? Well, I think it's fair to say here that we have not had anything so contested since that election of 1876. So we have had over a century of very, very non-dramatic, very heavy on ceremony, very light on drama, with an occasional protest here or there, but it's really been seen as a sort of waving a flag about an issue, about voting in Ohio in 2004, or about voting in Florida in 2001. But it's always been seen as just a final, let's make a small stand here. What has to happen here and why we're facing this sort of much more dramatic episode today is that the president's allegations of fraud, despite having been rejected by dozens of state and federal courts, including the Supreme Court, despite those rejections of his claims, the president has really turned today's assembly into really a litmus test. Are you with me or against me? And that has removed the attention, right? They're not really quibbling about whether or not these are valid certificates of votes or whether they've been lawfully certified. I mean, they're not really doing that. They say they are, the Republican opponents. But what they're really doing is it's a loyalty test. Now, from the president's perspective, well, I hesitate to get into his mind, but the president's perspective is pushing Vice President Pence to basically throw out the valid votes, which is not a power the vice president has.
Right, right. So let's talk about these objections. So if someone does formally object to a state's election results, what happens next?
So the process is written into the law. And it says that a House member must have the consent of a Senate member. They both have to put their objection into writing. And then when a state is called, if you are going to object to Arizona, you rise and get recognized to make that objection. Now, if you check the boxes, House member, Senate member, written on paper, then remember, they're in joint session, the House and Senate. We're in the House chamber, though. The Senate and the senators have to walk back to the Senate chamber. The House will meet separately. The Senate meets separately. The law says you can vote for 2 hours. You can debate for 2 hours, but no more. And then there's an up or down vote on that objection. And it takes a majority vote in the chamber. But the law also says you need a bicameral agreement. The House has to object it, and the Senate has to object the state's electoral votes in order to actually not count those votes.
So do you expect, that's quite a process, so do you expect this to be hours, days? What is your expectation if you have one?
So there's a little uncertainty about how far Republicans want to go. There seems to be some agreement amongst Senate Republicans that they will challenge Arizona, that they will be challenging Pennsylvania, and that they want to challenge Georgia. However, on the House side, there's support for challenging several more. Let's say they did three challenges.
Okay.
And each state is done separately. And we know that there's up to a two-hour debate. So that's 6 hours right there. We're under COVID sort of restrictions in the way they vote in the House. And so you have to add at least a half hour, maybe an hour, to each of those votes. And the senators have to walk back and forth and so forth. So conceptually, we're talking about a 12-hour, sort of into the wee hours of the night. However, these are senators. They don't like to spend a lot of time trudging back and forth, as we say in Washington. Sometimes when they're about to go, and they are going to go in recess until the inauguration, we think. Sometimes we say they smell jet fumes, they're ready to go home, so I don't think we can eliminate the possibility that after one or two objections, three at most, that they call it quits.
All right, we have a minute left. Let's talk about Mike Pence. You mentioned him earlier. What's the role of the vice president, and does he have any real power?
The vice president is a glorified letter opener today. That's his role. He opens the envelope, he hands them to the House and Senate tellers, and at the end, he reports back the numbers. He doesn't even say who is elected. He just announces that who has how many votes.
Okay,
Trump
so
and Biden.
Is there any chance that today will alter the results of the November's presidential election?
It may take a while to get there, but at the end, Biden and Harris will be president and vice president-elect for sure.
Sarah Binder is a professor of political science at George Washington University and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Sarah, thank you very much for being here.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Okay, everyone, that's a Wednesday takeaway for you. Thanks for taking part of your day to be with us. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. We also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and send them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and this is The Takeaway.